Caleb Parsons is 6'9 swing man. You can shoot the three.
Urban Meyer, a liar. Don't believe a word he said.
Look at you go. Look at that. It's like seeing a kid ride a bike.
And I'm going to law school, baby. It all starts here.
Hello and welcome to a very special Alligator Sports podcast. This show is brought to you from my car, the Toyota Echo 2003, which is currently somewhere between Memphis and Oklahoma City. I don't really know where we are right now, but we're on I-40. I'm Adam Berry, the assistant sports editor and softball beat writer for Alligator Sports, and joining me and currently driving my car
is Kyle Maestri, incoming football beat writer and columnist.
And the two of us are, as we said on the last podcast, heading out to Oklahoma City to bring you coverage of the Women's College World Series, which UF is playing in starting tomorrow night, Thursday night at 9. It's been quite an interesting trip so far. It got off to a weird start, even weirder than it would have normally, I like to think. We're going to start off, we're going to head out at 7 a.m. and just drive the whole 18 hours straight through, which is ridiculous in its own right. But we changed it up a little bit, didn't we, Kyle?
Yeah, well, it's never good enough just to be that first level of ridiculous. We have to take the extra mile. So
we learned from Phil Kegler.
Yeah, exactly. I threatened not sleeping beforehand because we're college kids, we're on bad sleep schedules, let's be real. And you kind of said, well, we could just leave right now. This was about 2 a.m. or so.
Yeah.
By the time we were done packing and stuff, it was like 3:30 and we hit the road. So we switched off taking naps and driving. And both of us, I think, are pretty well rested at this point now that we've crossed the Mississippi River.
Absolutely.
And we're on about a 450-mile straight shot to Oklahoma City.
Yeah, I started off on the first driving shift on my own accord. I felt like it felt right to drive my car the first leg of the trip. So I started off driving at night. I figured you were going to stay with me because you are a night person, but then we get about an hour outside of Gainesville. It's pitch black, nothing happening. We're listening to a Bill Simmons podcast, as we are wont to do. And you're like, all right, I'm gonna take this one out, take a nap. So at that point, I'm starting to worry a little bit for myself because, you know, it's a long drive at night and there's literally nothing going on. So I'd switch over to the ever dependable road trip playlist, consisting of a lot of Fleetwood Mac and Matchbox 20, as those close to me know. And I gotta say, that got me through the night. And then when the sun came up, I got like a new burst of energy. So I was able to make it to the point where you woke up about, I think it was Macon, Georgia?
Yeah, I think Macon's about right.
In Macon, Georgia, where Kyle took over driving. I passed out shortly thereafter, although I do now remember waking up occasionally and commenting really weird comments on the Adam Carolla podcast we were listening to.
Yeah, definitely.
Was I not with it?
Yeah, I mean, you seem to be laughing in your sleep at times, if that's at all possible. But it's kind of like you were asleep, you'd laugh, say that was ridiculous or something of the sort, and then kind of turn over and go back to bed. But yeah, I mean, the whole trip has been fun and a little bit overwhelming. But we got through it. We navigated through Memphis, found a good rib place to eat at, which I was happy about.
Absolutely.
Because we kind of messed up the food schedule with the whole leaving early thing, which I'm disappointed about. We got to Atlanta real quick, too early for Gladys Knight's Chicken and Waffles, my personal favorite spot.
Man.
And we got to Birmingham too quick to eat at Dreamland for lunch. So we had to hold over till Memphis. And at the recommendation of one of my friends who has been to Memphis and pure dumb luck, we found this place called Rendezvous, which was a pretty legit barbecue joint in Memphis, and we ate in downtown Memphis.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't understand a word the man was saying.
No,
was offering
no, yeah,
food,
yeah. The Memphis accent is like no other. It's, I mean, it's like Hustle and Flow, really, all over again. I felt like I was in the middle of that movie.
Yeah, even as somebody who's lived in Tennessee, I feel like I'm familiar enough with Southern accents to hold my own or whatever. But that guy came up to us. All I understood was ribs and small and large, and I knew I couldn't handle the large.
Yeah.
I could barely handle the small. So I was staying away from the large at all costs there. So.
Yeah, I felt like our first encounter with said gentleman, I barely made out enough to get us into a table with a couple plates of ribs and some sweet tea. But the second encounter was a little rougher. He said something to me on the way out. I kind of smiled and nodded, but whatever. They were nice enough. And when you walk into a place and they say, we can only serve you ribs, one thing, you know that thing is going to be very good. As Evan Drexler said about Dreamland, and it held true in this scenario, so I was happy we did that for sure.
Absolutely, I'm not a huge barbecue guy myself, you know, despite being from the South or whatever, but I gotta say, that completely worked for me. But what doesn't work for me is the situation we're in right now in the car. We've got a semi-truck in front of us, we're in the left lane, two lanes, and a semi-truck to our right in front of us. We are boxed in the worst imaginable situation. I've yet to come up with a name for this phenomenon that happens on the road, but yeah. I have to say that it's my least favorite thing.
Yeah, this is pretty bad. I mean, we got an 18-wheeler on one side, another one in front of us, what looks like an oil drum to the right. I mean, we're not going anywhere for a while, so to speak. So, I mean, I don't know. Driving on the road has been a long process. And I also want to comment on the fact that even though we're out of the office, we still have to do this under, like, extreme sauna temperatures because we turned off the AC to avoid interference, which, you know, is the right move for all the listeners out there. But I'm too fat to keep doing this kind of stuff. I'm melting here in the driver's seat.
I like to think that staying in my apartment for the few days before we got on this trip prepared you for that.
Yeah, except that I had, like, an intravenous flow of Gatorade and water in your apartment. I probably sucked down whatever the difference was you were saving in AC bills just in Gatorade and water over the 3 days I stayed there. So
that might be true. But then, of course, we start on this drive, and I guess around the time you woke up, around the time we got to Macon, my air conditioner in the car was not exactly doing us any favors here. No. It was making a really weird sound and not blowing out the full, you know, level of air.
I mentally jinxed us. I take responsibility for this one. Because when we first got in the car and I was trying to go to sleep, it was really friggin' cold in here, like really cold. And I said to myself, Kyle, I hope it's not this cold the whole drive. And it wasn't that cold the whole drive. The AC gave out. We kind of got screwed for a while there. But it appeared to be rejuvenated after we left Memphis.
Yeah.
So hopefully it holds up for the rest of the trip.
I'd argue that it was just as rejuvenated as us after the ribs.
Absolutely. The ribs were great. Expensive, but very good. Some nice dry rub. Some authentic Memphis ribs for sure.
Yeah, certainly. And also, you mentioned, you know, not being in the office, but we are still writing stories here. You'll see in Thursday's Alligator, I definitely had a lot of stuff going on there. Kyle, you're doing some work for some state papers
right.
as well. So we're still doing some stuff. We're doing it on deadline, but we can't do anything in the normal way here because we've literally spent all day on the road. So at about 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock this morning, Central Time, because we made that switch and it messed me up when I woke up, I got a call from Stephanie Brombacher, who I was doing an interview with. But of course, at the time, Kyle and I were in the worst Burger King in the southeastern United States.
Well, elaborating on that, I had just covered the SEC baseball tournament, you know, last weekend, and the first leg of the trip is the exact same drive. It's north on 75 to Atlanta, then west on 20 to Birmingham, where, you know, the SEC tournament was held in Hoover.
Mm-hmm.
So when we got there, you know, we had to use the bathroom, we had to fill up the gas tank, and the gas station had a one-man bathroom, someone was using it, didn't look too good anyway, so we moved it along to the next place. It was too early in the morning, we tried two other places, both were closed. Our fourth stop was Burger King, and we had to wait a good 20 minutes to get into the one-man bathroom they had in that Burger King because some employee was you know, dropping a deuce. I don't know what I can say on this podcast, but he wasn't going number one, I can tell you that. So it took us forever to get in and out of there. By the time we finally did, you got the call on your phone, and I was driving, so you were able to scribble down some notes. No, nothing conventional whatsoever. We thought we were going to be able to send our stories out yesterday before we left, but we were misinformed about the actual date of the press conference in Oklahoma City. We thought it was going to be yesterday. It was today.
Yes.
So we had to stop in a McDonald's just inside of Arkansas, just over the Mississippi, where they had a really nice Wi-Fi setup going on. We paid a couple bucks and sent all our stories in on time.
I'm going to argue that outside of Orlando, that might be the nicest McDonald's I've ever been to. I don't know how you feel about that.
I mean, yeah, I don't frequent the inside of McDonald's too much anymore, but yeah, it was very nice. I was impressed. It had, you know, it was like meant for people like us, I felt like. I don't know. I was really nervous when we got it off. It was going to be some really run-down McDonald's where they've never even heard of Wi-Fi, so I was pleasantly surprised, to be sure.
Actually, I'm going to take back exactly what I said. I'm going to say third, because the people in Japan, they love their McDonald's. They do it up over there. Their McDonald's, that's like fine dining to some people over there. So I was, in fact, inside a very nice McDonald's over there. when I spent some time over there my senior
year. But domestically, top two?
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay,
I mean,
cool.
Yeah, can't be touched, can't be touched. But let's talk about actually, you know, why we're on this trip.
Wait,
both...
one more thing. All right. Before we get out of the trip portion of this,
yeah.
Something has to be said. All right. You guys ever get the pleasure of driving 18 hours out to Oklahoma City and you take much the same route that we do, you will get on a interstate highway, 78, just that will take you west of Birmingham and north into Memphis. About 30 minutes west of Birmingham, you will encounter a strip of land about 3, 4, 5 miles long that I'm going to call Bingo Row. I am shocked at what we saw and appalled, quite frankly. There were no less than 11 bingo places in a 5 mile span, and probably 6 in a 1 mile span.
Yeah.
And they were all themed to this weird crap. There was like Southern Bell bingo and like pirate bingo and some weird stuff. So I'm going to try to make sense of this with you. We can try to talk this out because I have no idea why this is so prevalent and why there's so many, what the demand for bingo is. And we need to try to piece some things together. Any listeners out there who know the real story, you can shoot us an email.
I'm going to guess a lot of senior citizens, you know, they love their bingo.
Okay.
However.
That's the first thing that crossed my mind too, because we grew up in South Florida. You know, maybe the grandparents like to play a little bingo on the weekends.
Of course.
But I'm going completely different here. Anybody who's seen 8 Mile, okay? Eminem's mother in 8 Mile was always trying to hit bingo big, right? They were real poor. They lived in a trailer. And her dream, like Rosie Perez in White Men Can't Jump, you know, was the Jeopardy equivalent. She just wanted to hit bingo so they could get some money. And Eminem was always telling her, Mom, you're never going to hit bingo. You're stupid for going, whatever, whatever. So what I'm thinking, and when we got there, when we passed Bingo Row, there were a bunch of the bingos that said Charity Bingo. Now, it wasn't in a nice area, so my assumption is that you're playing for money there. You're not giving it away. It's not charity. You're not paying to sit down, and then they then rake your money off the table and give it to the American Cancer Foundation or, you know, whatever that is. So my thing is, I think it's a poor area. And, like, maybe some kind of, like, operation where they actually get money from wherever, I'm not really sure. Mm-hmm. And you go play for free.
Okay.
Like, within whatever confines of the community. Maybe it's tax deductible for some, like, bigger company.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out the logistics of this. I don't know any of this to be true. I'm just kind of working it out in the process of this podcast. But I'm saying it's a poor area. You got a bunch of lower class socioeconomically going to these places trying to get money, like Eminem's mom in 8 Mile, and that's where the charity part factors in. What do you think about that theory?
I liked my other theory better, that they're just all a bunch of meth labs in disguise.
Yeah, well, either that or meth labs, definitely.
I mean, feel like it's either or at this point.
Yeah.
It's either charity bingo is in the exact way you just described, or definitely meth labs.
Meth labs. And if had I driven the car into the next bingo place we saw, like I promised, maybe it would have exploded and we could have got a definitive answer.
Yeah.
But I don't know, maybe when we get to Oklahoma City, I'll do some research on charity bingo halls and try to piece some stuff together. But I couldn't be more confused. We'll try to figure this out, I guess.
Absolutely, and we will do more research. We would have maybe done it at the McDonald's, but we had 7 hours to drive ahead of us, and I think we only had about 2 hours of internet that we paid for there, so there's only so much we can do with that.
Right.
There was one other thing about the trip that I wanted to get your comment on, because I have what some people might call a unique car. The console is in the center, you know, like your odometer and everything, and your speedometer, all in the center, so it's not right in front of you. It's small. It lacks a lot of features, you know, power windows, power locks, a clock built in naturally. How have you found driving the Echo? Because we've split the driving duties.
All right, I'm gonna compare the Echo to like kind of a low rate motel type place where you walk in and like the shower doesn't quite work and you have no water pressure and like the fundamentals are missing, but they're trying to make it up to you with like continental breakfast and like some weird stuff you don't really need, like maybe a mint on the pillow. It's like, oh, well, that's nice. And had everything else been in place, I would have really appreciated that.
They fold
but
up
because
your towels.
You couldn't give me running water, I'm a little bit perturbed. I mean, we're hitting a 450-mile stretch right now, and I don't have cruise control to work with, and I'm a little nervous. Like, I mean, I'm trying to keep the same speed here. You know, cruise control would greatly help out. my legs and, you know, just the whole process. I feel like power locks would have been a welcomed accessory on this trip.
Perhaps.
But, you know, it has its benefits, though. It has its mint on the pillow. You got plenty of little compartments to keep all, you know, our phones and wallets and sunglasses and things of that nature. So it does okay. It does great on gas, which is obviously a big plus in a situation like this.
Yeah.
But my main beef is, I think as long as the AC stays running, we can be friends. Me and the Echo can be friends.
That's good. Because I've long since made my peace with the Echo, and me and the Echo were, you know, one and the same.
You're boys.
Yeah, we're boys. All right, and now I guess we're ready to move on to the work part of the trip. This is just would you call this the fun part of the trip? I don't know, the drive part of the trip, I suppose. I don't know.
Yeah, I think this is the fun part.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is what we're going to get into a little bit here, but the work part for us is absolutely fun.
Definitely.
Mostly because both of us have now covered this softball team for a year each. You know, you've kept up with it this year. I followed a little bit last year because I started working when, you know, they were making their Women's College World Series run at the end of last year. But covering this team, you know, like, it's worth driving out here for. It's, you know, it's worth coming to Oklahoma City and driving 18 hours in a car that doesn't have cruise control and driving through the terrible parts of Alabama with the 1,000 bingo things in a row. What is it about this team, though, to you, that's so much fun to cover?
Well, you know, I covered it last year. I covered the same event. Defer and I flew out to Oklahoma City. And so I knew what I was getting into, so I wouldn't have volunteered to go out and drive, do the drive with you if I didn't think it was worth it, obviously. It's not only the team, the Gators, that are so exciting to watch, although they are very exciting. It's the whole event that's really great. I think the Women's College World Series is a lot of fun. 99% of the games are highly, highly competitive. One or two run games, it can go either way.
Yeah.
You get to see the best pitching that you'll see in college for softball or baseball on a consistent basis. You get to see great players really do great things, and I think that's what makes it so fun. And the other thing is, this is the last time that these players get to play on a big stage. You know, you can go ahead, you can go play on the USA team if you're really, really good, but only, you know, half of a percent of college players are going to get to do that in their lifetime.
Yeah.
So, you know, they may play in a softball league for a couple of years, either here or overseas professionally. It's not going to make them much money. They're just doing it for the love of the game at that point. But it's not like you're going to have ESPN cameras on you, you know, in those leagues.
Yeah.
So this is really the last chance they get to really make a name for themselves, do something cool that their friends and families can see on TV, and go out on top, really, if you're a senior.
Yeah, all right. I'll agree to that. But I think, to me, like you mentioned in a column you wrote earlier in the week about how much, you know, how softball is enjoyable in its own right to cover. And I've completely found that to be true. Because you grew up with baseball. We've talked about this a lot. You grew up with baseball. You've always liked baseball. I didn't have that quite as much. But, you know, and I didn't necessarily know how that would impact me covering this beat. But I stepped in, and it's such a different sport that it's so much fun to cover in its own right. You know, it's faster paced. Everything gets done pretty quickly. And, you know, a lot of the exciting plays, the home runs and everything like that. So that is fun enough to cover as a sport, but also the athletes, to me, are really what make the sport worth covering. Because like you said, you know, they're doing this for love of the game, but they're also, like, it's the biggest sport you can cover where the athletes aren't necessarily just athletes. You know, like, they're student athletes still. I view most of these players as. I don't know how you feel about that, but
yeah, I mean, each one of these girls, they're all earning a degree that they're going to use in the future. Softball is not going to be their life for 99.999% of them after they graduate. And, I mean, I think coming out here, it really gives you a chance to see all the top-level teams compete against each other. So you're going to get the best that the sport has to offer.
Yeah.
You know, and there's the level of consistency with the great pitchers where the great pitchers are going to pitch well every time they take the mound. So I would argue that even if you went out to Omaha for the College Baseball World Series, you're not necessarily guaranteed the best baseball of the year.
Yeah.
Maybe the ACC tournament happened to be better that year. Maybe the Pac-10 tournament happened to be better that year.
Yeah.
As far as the quality of baseball that's being played. But when you get out to Oklahoma City, you will see the best softball of the year played right in front of you by all the best players.
Yeah.
And that's really what's fun. And you get to really see how well these girls do everything. And, you know, they're really just, they're good at what they do, and it's a lot of softball people don't like the game being compared to baseball because they say it's completely different.
Yeah.
And it is different, but I feel like in a way they should try to embrace the similarities to baseball if they can, because I wrote this in, you know, a while ago to one of my friends, like, America loves baseball, but America's only lukewarm on softball.
Yeah,
so if they
yeah.
can kind of tap into that culture, say, hey, we're a little bit like baseball, we have some differences, but you'll like it,
yeah.
I think that would help out the sport a little bit and maybe get it back in the Olympics.
Yeah, absolutely, especially if they showcase sort of the personality some of their players have, because I think, you know, going back to even some of the better players, you know, the Jenny Finches of the past, you know, who've come through this very tournament that we're about to go cover, like, these people have a lot of personality that, personally, we've talked about this before as well, I don't feel like baseball players really bring, especially at the college level.
No, absolutely. I mean, they're real honest. They're real emotional.
Yeah.
They're really just, I don't know, they're much bigger personalities. They don't get all the media coverage that all the other sports do. So I don't think they're as prepared to give the company line, which is
yeah.
refreshing.
Absolutely.
So they're not always going to shut you down. They're going to answer you honestly. Every single, you'll see as the teams get eliminated, I told you this, every single press conference, they'll bring out the seniors that were on the teams. It was their last go at things, and they'll just sit there and cry and answer questions for 15 or 20 minutes. And it's kind of sad, but it's you know, it's refreshing. You see how much it really means to the girls that play in the World Series.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, now we're going to move on here. We're going to talk about some UF-specific storylines, some stuff that's just come up today. Tuesday night, the two biggest awards, I think you could argue, in college softball were given out. The National Player of the Year and the Low Senior Class Award. The Low Senior Class Award was given to Florida's Stacy Nelson. That's more about recognizing, you know, what they do off the field in the classroom and the community, as well as what they do on the field. She's actually the first Gator to ever win it. Brandon MacArthur is up for it this year for baseball, I believe. So, like, what do you think that award sort of means for her? I personally feel like this is more relevant for her than winning National Player of the Year is, almost.
I couldn't really disagree more with that. It's like the participation trophy, or like, not the participation, the sportsmanship award, like in your league, you know, like some kid brings home the MVP, some kid gets a Cy Young, and then you kind of got like, oh, you're the best sport of all in the league. That's kind of what I feel like this award is. And I don't want to like poo-poo it too much, because it is like, it's meaningful that she has time to not only do her schoolwork and be a full-time student-athlete, but also do good things in the community and all that kind of stuff. That's really important, and I commend her for that. But, I mean, you and me could have done the same things to earn those awards if we were student-athletes. It's not like you and me can't strike out 320 hitters and have a 0.41 ERA.
Yeah.
So it's all about the Player of the Year award for me.
All right, well, as the recipient of many coaches' awards, I take personal offense to your slamming of that kind of award. But I'm saying, like, to her, I think this almost means just as much, you know, that she's being recognized for that, because you and I know, like, for her on-the-field stuff, like, she doesn't even care that much about the numbers and stuff. I think, you know, she cares a lot more about what she's doing off the field, so maybe to her, I agree with your point that, you know, the Player of the Year is obviously more prestigious and a bigger deal, but I think to her, maybe, is the point I'm trying to make.
All right, maybe, I'll give you a maybe. I kind of want to ask her that question,
yeah.
since obviously she's the only one who can answer that, but I feel like she's just going to say, yeah, this means more to me, kind of no matter what.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, I can't imagine if she was picking an award at the beginning of the year, she would have picked this one instead.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm sure it means a lot to her. I'm sure she's very proud of it, as she should be.
Yeah.
I just feel like, say that you were the most outstanding player in college softball for a season is pretty impressive and something that you'll be remembered for. You know, when people go write stories about softball for years to come,
yeah.
they'll be looking up your name and putting your name in stories, and this just simply isn't the case with the Low Senior Class Award.
That's true. That's a good point. And the winner of it actually was a junior from Washington, Danielle Lori. We've talked about her before on this show. You know, the pitcher Washington, she strikes out, I think she struck out 150-odd more batters than Stacy did this year.
She was up over 450, I don't know what the number was
yeah,
for sure.
Somewhere in the 470 range. I mean, she is really a dominant pitcher, and we'll get to see a lot of that coming up this week at the tournament here. But I mean, could you make you would have made the argument for Stacey to win it, correct?
I'm kind of torn on this issue because I felt that Stacey should have won last year.
Okay.
And Tincture won instead, which it's kind of hard to argue with because she was so dominant. But I feel like the strikeout is just a little bit overrated. I kind of have a problem with teams winning the award, or pitchers winning the award on strikeout alone, which is kind of what it seems like it happened, because Stacey's ERA is half as much as Laurie's.
Yeah.
And it's not like Laurie has a 2 ERA, so half as much is relative. It's like she has a 0.8 ERA and Stacey has a 0.4, which is completely absurd.
Yeah.
But Laurie struck out more batters, and it's not that Stacey's not striking anyone out. She's up over a strikeout per inning. So I think the way they're defining dominant is in the conventional sense of she's striking girls out, like they can't even touch her, whereas Stacey's dominant in a more subtle kind of way, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I felt like the reason she didn't get it last year, or the reason that, you know, you could kind of make peace with it, was because Tincture was a senior and she was heading out. And I'm never one for giving somebody a award just on based on seniority, but if it's kind of, if it's real close, then I can kind of understand. And I feel like Stacey wasn't extended that same courtesy this year as Laurie won it as a junior. The other candidate was Caitlin Cochran from Arizona State, who is probably the best hitter in the nation. Her OBP is over 600, which is, like, retarded. And her slugging percentage is, like, 900, which is equally retarded.
It's stupid, yeah.
So, I mean, the only thing that I would make an argument against her was that, is that she's a hitter.
Yeah.
And this is really a pitcher sport.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of where I stand on all that. I would have given it to Stacey because I feel like her and Laurie are comparable at best if Stacey doesn't have the nod, and she's a senior on her way out. Laurie's going to get a chance to do it again next year.
That's, that's the thing to me, and that's why I would have given it to Stacey personally. Laurie is insanely dominant, and not just in the strikeout sense necessarily. Like, she shut out so many top 25 teams. You look at it, she shut out, like, UCLA. She has shut out everyone, you know, including Florida. You know, they got 2 hits on her in 9 innings, so she is really a dominant pitcher. But, again, Stacey had, like, the body of work over this season and last season. You know, I don't like doing the 2 years combined thing, but if you are going to snub somebody the year before like that based on her not being a senior, I don't think it's fair to not give it to her in her senior year.
Right.
But it is a close contest.
Yeah, I agree with that.
All right, and then I guess the other thing we wanted to talk about here was some storylines that came out of some press conferences today. Arizona's player, who is it, Sam, what's the last name on that girl?
I had it before.
Yeah, it's been a long game for us, you gotta understand. It's starting to rain right now, our attention is elsewhere on the road. But this girl, she said that, you know, she viewed her team as the underdog, which she should. They're the number 9 seed in the tournament, they're playing the number 1 seed.
She plays for Arizona,
Yeah, Arizona first baseman. And, you know, Walton, Coach Tim Walton, responded to that in his press conference by saying that he disagreed with her. He called her out by name, which unfortunately we are not able to do because we can't remember her name. But he called her out by name and said he disagrees with her because he views his team as the underdog because Arizona has such a historically good program. I don't really know how I feel about that yet. Kyle, go ahead and share your input on that.
It's asinine. Like, Walton really, I mean, I guess he's trying to take some pressure off of his players. Because, you know, it's kind of harder to win when you're on the radar and everybody's coming after you instead of sneaking up on people. But they're coming into this as the number 1 seed for the 2nd year in a row.
Yeah.
They've lost 3 games. They have the number 1 and 2 ERA pitchers in college softball. You know, they're clearly the favorite. The next best record is Alabama, and they're 52-9. So they're a full 6 losses behind them.
Yeah.
And Arizona's coming in with 15 losses. So, and their best pitcher's ERA is 2.4. Like, they are clearly the underdog in this game. And history plays no part in it. I mean, UF knocked out UCLA last year. And UCLA is the most storied program in college softball. They have 10 titles, which is the most. Arizona's 2nd with 8.
Yeah.
And it's just ridiculous. Had he said this last year, I think I would have bought into it because UCLA and Arizona were still in the field. they hadn't played teams like that yet, and they both had first-team All-American pitchers. And this year, they don't. You know, Arizona does not. So I just was a little put off by the whole thing. And he doesn't have to go ahead and say, yeah, we're the best, we should win easily, duh. But he doesn't have to call his team the underdog either.
I'll agree to that. I think, you know, pointing, you know, even positioning his team as the underdog in this game is absurd. Like, it's underselling his team in a certain sense. Like, you know, maybe we, you know, won't come out and win this thing. You know, don't expect us to win or whatever. Like, that's, like you said, that's absurd to even, you know, even position his team as that, in that way. I do think it's kind of nice that he's not viewing Florida as already the elite program that maybe some people build it up to be, because they haven't won it yet. And he is acknowledging that Arizona has won it multiple times and has made the tournament 21 out of 22 times or something absurd like that.
Right. By tournament, you don't mean NCAA tournament. You mean the College World
Series. Yeah, right. Absolutely. So I like it in that sense, but I agree with you that I don't like it in the sense that, you know, he's selling his team short a little bit in that way, because they are absolutely the favorite. It would almost not be a huge surprise if they came out and mercy ruled them with the way Arizona's pitching staff looks right now.
And we know for sure that this is not at all how the players feel.
Yeah.
So it's one thing if you kind of buy into, like, okay, Walton's, like, really manipulating his players and he's going to put them in a better mindset.
Yeah.
But you talked to Brombacher today, and she said, none of us will be satisfied unless we leave with a championship.
Yep.
And that's absolutely the attitude for all of them, I guarantee you.
It always has been.
Yeah. And this is just Walton being Walton, really. Like, this is, I know every once in a while I talk to a couple of players, like, oh, you know how coach is. Coach is going to be coach.
Yeah.
That kind of a thing.
He's just going to be coach.
Right. And I think this is just him doing that. I mean, if he went into that, you know, if he went into a meeting with the team and tried to sell that to them, I think they'd look at him and be like, come on, let's be honest here. We're supposed to win this thing. We're going to treat it as such. So I feel like he's just doing it for this for the media's sake.
Okay.
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, that's the point I was going to make. Do you think he even believes? I mean, he doesn't believe that for a second, right?
No, he'd be foolish to.
Yeah.
There's no chance he thinks that. I mean, you'll see, if they make it to the finals and they lose, it's still going to be disappointing, and the mood will reflect such. I think it's going to be hard for them to look back and say, hey, we had a great run, because they're supposed to win. They're supposed to win this year.
Yeah, and they, you know, that's been their thing since the beginning of the year, is that this is our year, you know, this is our chance to win the whole thing. Anything less than that is a failure in this team's mind, so... Yeah, I mean, look out for that in the future. If he does that again next round, or, you know, he does it again if Florida wins, and, you know, or they lose, and he's like, oh, you know, I just don't know if we're, you know, we are where we, you know, we thought we were, or something like that. Keep an eye on his comments in the future, because they are mostly positioning his team to the media in a certain way.
Right.
So let's move on to the other topic that came out of that press conference. The Arizona coach talked a little bit about the parity between the SEC and the Pac-10, and I don't have the quote in front of me, but he basically said, like, you know, when he knew that the SEC was coming into college softball, he knew it was only a matter of time until they really started to take over. And as you can see this year, you know, they haven't taken over yet, because it is even in terms of the number of teams in the Women's College World Series. It's 3 each. But, you know, even he kind of discounted Georgia, the third SEC team in there. So what did you think about his comments overall?
The Arizona coach is Mike Candrea, who is really the Coach K, I would compare him to, of college softball, in that he's won a bunch of titles with, you know, Arizona, built the program, and actually I think he may have inherited the program, so I may be wrong in that, but the real comparison I'm trying to draw is that he coaches the national team also, like Coach K coached the national team for basketball.
Yeah.
So he's the current head coach of the national team. He had to leave the team last year when the Olympic stuff was going on. They had an interim coach whose name escapes me.
Mm-hmm.
But he's, you know, he's an authority on softball.
Yeah.
So anything he says is to be taken pretty seriously.
Yeah, so.
And, he sung the SEC some praises. And, I mean, the thing that he pointed to, and any college athletic fans can recognize this, is that the SEC schools and their fan bases take all sports very, very seriously. They're not in it just to participate and just to have a team. And they're in it to win, you know, and they're in it to be the best conference, no matter what sport it is.
Yeah.
So, though the SEC just picked up softball in 1997, they've really come a long way, and in these last few years, It started with LSU in Tennessee, and it's been passed since to Florida and Alabama.
Yeah.
They've challenged. They've had Monica Abbott's. They've had Stacey Nelson's. They've had really strong players come through who are, you know, nationally recognizable.
Yeah.
And, you know, they could reel off a couple championships here in the next couple years. You're not going to see UCLA and Arizona State and Arizona win every single year anymore. It's just not going
to
be like that.
And I think that's mainly the point he's trying to make, in that also, like, you know, you are going to start seeing a little fair representation here. Like, it's not going to be six Pac-10 schools or whatever. Like, you could consistently at this point see Alabama and Florida in here for the next couple of years. Even with the classes that they'll lose, these two teams have built programs. That's the point he's trying to make. They've built softball programs that can be reckoned with. It's not just a one-time thing anymore, which you could argue Tennessee was with Monica Abbott. I would, at least. So I think, you know, that's really the point he's trying to make. So if the SEC is here, it's here to stay, and it's, you know, probably going to start challenging the Pac-10's dominance for the time being. Certainly not going to challenge that in a historical sense, because the Pac-10's already sort of established their reign, I think. I don't know.
Yeah, and I was watching Cold Pizza a few weeks ago, or a month ago, however long ago it was, and, or maybe what is it, First Take now?
Yeah,
it's not Cold Pizza anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is anymore. Jay Crawford, who was asking
The show formerly known as Cold Pizza.
This young woman some questions, and she was a high school pitcher. I forget which state she was from the South somewhere, and she's thrown like 20-something no-hitters in her career. Maybe it's 20-something perfect games, and like a bunch more no-hitters, and like her career ERA is like 0.01 or like something unbelievable. She's just as dominant as you can possibly be. And, you know, they had her in the studio and we're interviewing her, and she's going to LSU next year. I don't remember her name, I'm sorry, but, you know, we'll all know it next year because she should be lights out if she's even half as good as she was in high school. So, you know, those are the kind of players that the SEC is getting as well as far as recruiting goes. And you see it with Florida, where half of their roster is made up of California players.
Yep.
And why, you know, if you're a softball player from California, you don't have to go very far to go to an elite program. Obviously, UCLA and Arizona and Arizona State, they're all right there. You can go to any of those programs that you want to, but they came all the way across the country and went to Florida.
Yep.
So, I mean, yeah, it's an even playing field at this point, and that little era of dominance is likely over. I mean, the Pac-10's always going to have very good teams, but not so much that the other schools and other conferences can't compete with them.
It's really at this point about other schools going over there to recruit and sort of, you know, establishing recruiting bases over there, which Florida has certainly done. I think Alabama's done it as well.
Right.
You know, like, you can tell because they're the really good teams out there. They're the ones who've gone over to the West Coast and sort of picked some talent over there that wasn't interested in going to some West Coast schools as well. Like, I mean, Stacey Nelson is a prime example. She wanted to go to a school that had a good football program. And, you know, where better to go than Florida or an SEC school. So
yeah.
I think you'll see a lot more of that.
Absolutely. And a lot of the California girls that are on the team right now, they played together in high school in some capacity or another. And Shawnee Harris and Asia Pacova played on the same team. And they played on the same team with Kelsey Bruder. And Kelsey Bruder's mom coached the team. And Kelsey Bruder, her first semester of college, her freshman year, softball season isn't a fall sport, obviously, but she went to one of the UC schools. I think it was Irvine or Santa Barbara. It's one of the smaller UC schools. And she ended up transferring after that semester to come play in Florida.
Yeah.
And, you know, for obvious reasons, she had a couple of her teammates say, yo, this is legit down here. We can win some games. You should come play with us. And that was that. Now she's, you know, in 400 with 15 home runs for them. So they're obviously pulling the type of talent that's going to make them very good on a national scene every year.
Absolutely. We'll see if that talent pays off up here at Oklahoma City. Stay tuned to the Alligator Sports Podcast this coming week. We will have a lot more podcasts that are not recorded in my car and therefore will not have jumps like this or this. And they'll be a lot easier to understand, a lot easier to hear. You're still not going to have the clarity that we have with our new equipment. We're back to the MacBook and us, old school, me and my headphones and the MacBook, just like old times. But we'll be recording a lot of stuff, probably not nightly, but every once in a while, we're definitely going to record some podcasts and get them out here to you guys. And I guess that's it for today's show. Kyle, anything else you got to say from the road here?
Yeah, how do you feel about when they award the Player of the Year trophy? trophy. I know that they have a tournament most valuable player trophy as well, which is pretty prestigious in its own right, and some really big names have won that. But, you know, if Stacey Nelson beats Daniel Lari twice,
yeah,
and Florida kind of, you know, hits her around pretty good, I feel like it was almost decided on the field. It's kind of like the Heisman is given before the bowl game, and
yeah,
you get that Heisman curse effect where you get a lot of second guessing. So.
No, I completely agree with you. I think it's a terrible thing, and not just that, they recorded it like the party at the park, as they call it, which is like the pre, you know, WCWS event. You know, it's like, I don't know, it's really awkward timing. I don't like, you know, that they parade them around in front of other players. It's not like a media in school thing. It's like, hey, seven other schools with really talented players who are probably up for this award, look at this girl, aim for this girl. It's like putting a target on their back.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, that, I guess that answers.
Yeah, I don't know. It's not, I feel like they can push it back till after the tournament and vote on it then and decide then. I like the way they narrow it throughout the season. Like, it starts with a 50 watch list, then it gets down to 25 and 10 and 3, or, you know, however they cut it down. And that's really cool. It's like, cool to see if you made the cut, you know? Like,
I agree.
So, I like that, but I don't know. I feel like they can do something a little different with it. But Florida beat last year's Player of the Year, Angela Tincher, at the College World Series.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they've done that before. Nothing really they haven't done at this point. They have all the experience they need, and if they beat Lari, that'll be two Player of the Years in 2 years.
Absolutely, and they're on the other side of the bracket, though, so most likely the only way they'll meet is in the championship game, right?
Right.
I mean, that just provides Stacey with so much more motivation should they beat. And the hitters as well, to, you know, pull like the like you said, the Heisman thing, go out and sack Troy Smith a bunch because he won the Heisman.
Right. I mean, I don't know if they need any more motivation, but I think that's also the odds on matchup favorite if you're handicapping what the championship series is going to be. Florida and Washington are definitely the two favorites right now.
Alright, well, that's about it for today's show then. Thanks for listening through all the audio difficulties and, you know, some of the sort of the scratching we have going on in the background here. It's a very experimental podcast, but I think we had some fun recording it. I definitely look like a fool holding a MacBook wearing my big studio headphones in the front seat of my little Echo here.
And it helped occupy us for a small stretch of road on scenic I-40, so I'm glad we did it. I held you to it, and we did something cool.
Yeah. All right, and thanks for listening. Send any feedback to sports@alligator.org. Comment on our blogs.